Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, now in depth on Sessions, the swamp, and the persistent questions about ethics and this administration. As you've heard, Attorney General Jeff Sessions is testifying in a public hearing later today. He'll answer questions about his own contact with Russian officials. Remember, the Attorney General recused himself from any Justice Department investigations into Russian hacking or influence. But there is reporting that Sessions had a third meeting with Russian officials that he didn't disclose. And that if Sessions had recused himself from involvement in the Russian investigation, why was he apparently involved in the decision to fire James Comey, who was conducting a Russia investigation? We're also going to talk about the lawsuit the two attorneys general have filed against the president over the emoluments clause of the Constitution and what it means that a president who committed to drain Washington's swamp appears to be mired in potential conflicts of interest. As our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you this morning. Are there ethical questions about the administration or overall about the way Washington works? And I want to emphasize that as well. The way Washington works is something that voters have said they are very concerned about when it comes to ethics. So are there ethical issues about the administration or Washington that concern you, confuse you? Talk to us about it. Today we have two guests who I think can bring some clarity to your questions. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Meredith McGeehee is with us. She's Chief of Policy Programs and Strategy at Issue One, an organization focused on connecting the dots between money and politics. And she joins us from D.C. And Meredith, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Peter Henning is with us. He's a law professor at Wayne State University. Peter, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Meredith, Attorney General Sessions is going to be asked why, after recusing himself from the Russia investigation, he was, by President Trump's own words, involved in deciding to fire James Comey. So here's what I want to know. Is there an ethical problem there, or is it really more about politics, given that Mr. Comey was in the midst of investigating the White House and the campaign's links to Russia? Is it ethics or is it politics?
Well, it's actually, I would say, somewhat a matter of law, in that there are provisions in law for how this process should work, what a special counsel should do, how that special counsel should be appointed, and how that special counsel should be removed if there was a cause. So, yes, there's tons of politics surrounding all of this. Let's be very clear about that. At the same time, the fact that you have an attorney general who, on his own accord, did recuse himself from matters involving Russia does mean that the other standards should come into play. And I think that's where there's a lot of confusion here, is that at one moment, the attorney general had said, yes, I'm recusing myself because Attorney General Sessions participated in President Trump's campaign. One of the things that the DOJ has said, the Department of Justice has said, is that that was the only reason, and for that reason alone, did Sessions recuse himself from the Russia investigation, just his participation in the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But then he raises the question of, well, then why was he, if he was recused from that part, why was he involved in this decision about Comey? And that's just because when you recuse yourself, the expectation is, and the practice, and to some degree the law is, you do not then become part of that line decision.
Okay. So, Peter, to be clear here, the attorney general was not forced by law to recuse himself. This was a decision after taking in the ethics of the situation that he made on his own. But then, as Meredith is suggesting, then you observe the standards of that recusal. Is that how you see it?
Well, that is. This was a voluntary recusal by the attorney general that he saw he could be drawn into the investigation. Where it gets murky is that in the firing of Comey, at least we haven't heard that what the president did was communicated to Sessions and Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, that the reason I want Comey out is because of the Russian investigation. So it may well be that Sessions had a basis. The FBI is under the direction of the attorney general, that he would have a basis for being involved in the firing, perhaps. And maybe we'll get a little bit of clarity today at the hearing, although I rather doubt it, especially if executive privilege is asserted to let him refuse to provide answers to questions about his role in the firing of Comey.
Okay, so Meredith, this is a good point. Can you explain what asserting executive privilege would mean in this case?
Well, generally, the discussions between the president and his staff, and I put the staff, if you will, in quotes, because it really means almost all of the executive branch team that he has, can invoke executive privilege when they want to discuss matters of policy. Now, obviously, there are limits to that executive privilege. You cannot discuss illegal activities. That does not give you total carte blanche on everything that you might discuss with the president. But it is a longstanding tradition because you want to have this feeling that if you are a cabinet official or another high-ranking official that is in discussions with the president, you can give the president your honest, unvarnished opinion.
Okay.
And that will, if you know that those discussions are privileged, then, you aren't going to pull your punches, and that would be good for policy.
Okay. A call here from Gene in Bemidji. Hi, Gene. What are you thinking about on this discussion of ethics?
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Ethically speaking, all the tweets and leaks and information that comes out of the White House, in my mind, is not ethical. It is just they are simply distractions to take the American public and the media away from subjects of the day that are more paramount.
But you're talking about the president's personal communications,
yes.
Gene, via
yes.
Twitter. Peter, in your sense of this, is the president violating any kind of ethical standards in what he is saying on Twitter?
Maybe many of his Twitter postings have been intemperate, but I don't see any ethical violation. The danger, though, is that, and this has been raised by others, is that in some of his discussions or references on Twitter, that he may be exposing information that would undermine a claim of executive privilege.
That's
a very delicate area. So,
could you explain why that is, Peter?
Well, executive privilege, like any privilege in the law, is recognized to keep confidential information confidential. But if that information is exposed voluntarily,
okay,
then that undermines any privilege claim. So, for example, when the president referenced his discussions with Comey, that you'll note that the White House did not assert executive privilege when Comey testified. And so it may be that some of his statements have effectively overcome any claim of executive privilege. Now, he hasn't talked about anything he said with Jeff Sessions, so it may be that Sessions will be able to assert executive privilege if he wants to, and that can always be a very delicate issue.
This is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, to look ahead to the Attorney General's testimony this afternoon and to try to wrestle with some of the ethical questions that are going to come up and that are being discussed among members of the committee and, of course, members of the administration and the media and average Americans. So if you have questions about the ethics, some of the concerns, some of the things that you're hearing in the news or in general in politics in Washington, because I want to talk to our guests a little bit about money in politics today, too. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, and I'm on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Meredith, you're seeing the headlines, I'm sure, this morning about the president one of the president's closest friends saying that he's musing about potentially firing Robert Mueller. Legally, can he do that? Ethically, what might happen? And I should say Mueller, of course, is the independent counsel who was investigating the Russia situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, legally, the president cannot fire the special counsel. The special counsel under the statute can only be disciplined or removed by the personal action of the attorney general, which is the way the statute reads. Mm-hmm. And it has to be for misconduct, dereliction of duty, incapacity, or conflict of interest, or other good cause. There are standards with a written explanation for it. Now, that being said, if the attorney general is in fact recused on these matters, then the question of firing Mr. Mueller would go to Rod Rosenstein, who, of course, is now in the deputy position. We've seen this play somewhat before if it went down this way, where if he refused, then you might have what happened during Watergate and the Saturday Night Massacre. But we are not there yet, and so far this is totally speculation. But I would like to go back to a point that I think you raised and your caller raised, which is, is all of this in some ways a part of a distraction? Mm. Look, ethical standards are important, so we need to make sure that that's part of what makes a democratic system actually work versus just having laws. But we do need to remember that the bigger issue here is this question of Russian interference and the attempts to interfere in the election process. And that is a serious issue for any foreign entity to come in, and something that the founders of the Republic were concerned about from the get-go. So this is not a new issue. It's something that the founders spent a lot of time talking about and were concerned about. And, here we are with, I think, what at least so far we've seen is lots of information indicating that there was certainly attempts to interfere in our elections, and that is an issue which should concern every American.
I want to say, since we brought up Ron Rosenstein, that the Deputy Attorney General is testifying right now on Capitol Hill, and he is saying that Robert Mueller will have full independence in his probe. Of course, he's with the Justice Department, not with the White House, but he is assuring members of the Senate committee that Robert Mueller will be able to do what he needs to do in this investigation. Call here from Julie in Edina. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Carrie. How are you doing?
Doing good. What are you thinking about?
I am appalled that your guest has said that there is nothing illegal about some of the tweets that Donald Trump has made. Basically, okay, let's just consider one, and I'm not at my computer, so I can't do a lot of background research, but
all right.
He specifically said, buy L.L. Bean products as the president of the United States, and nothing happened.
So you're saying that...
And that's just one example. He does all these things, and they're not just questionable on an ethical level. They should be considered illegal.
All right.
How is that okay?
Let's go to Peter. Peter, what would you say to that?
What's the crime? Is the issue. It turns out under the conflict of interest statutes, the primary laws that are used when an individual in government works for their own personal financial interest, those specifically exempt the president, the vice president, and members of Congress and the judiciary, so that those laws couldn't be used against the president. If the president had accepted a bribe from L.L. Bean, I don't think there's ever been any claim about that. That could be a basis. But the optics certainly are bad, but it turns out the primary statutes in this area do not apply to the president himself. So, it doesn't look good. Maybe it ought to be a crime, but it's not a crime.
Peter, I'm interested in what you think when you see associates of the president's and some of this being leaked out, that he is maybe musing among friends about firing Mueller.
It may just be musing, or it is. Washington is known for its trial balloons. And
yeah, exactly.
What might the response be? I don't. The president attacks the mainstream media for fake news and things like that. But here comes a trial balloon that may be traceable to the White House. just to see, engage. And I don't think he's concerned so much about the broad swath of the electorate, but maybe more what the response within the Republican Party would be, especially on Capitol Hill. And so far, the response to that has been negative. But, you know, sometimes you condition the public for what you want to do and search for possible reasons. Newt Gingrich was reported to have said that Mr. Mueller is hiring bad people. They're very competent people, but they're Democrats, which I guess makes them bad. So maybe we're pointing toward another Saturday night massacre. I guess we'll have to see.
I have a tweet here, Meredith, from Gregory, who says, it's my understanding that executive privilege has to be asserted by the White House, not the other party, i.e. Sessions. Does that mean that they would tell the Attorney General that he must assert executive privilege with certain questions?
Well, in the past, this was a discussion that usually occurred between whoever was testifying and the White House counsel. And, you know, this would be something where there would be that kind of discussion about preparing for this kind of testimony. The White House counsel would provide guidance of when executive privilege they felt should be invoked. Usually the lawyers actually for the cabinet official would also be there, and that would be that kind of discussion. Because it's unclear how this White House counsel's office is actually operating, it's hard to know whether those kinds of discussions have occurred. But I would assume that there has been some guidance given to the Attorney General on those questions. Whether or not it is invoked by Sessions or whether or not it was directed by the White House to be invoked, I think is not going to be kind of the decisive question here about how much information Mr. Sessions actually in the end gives up. If he decides to invoke executive privilege, I think there would be a hard time pinning him down saying, oh, is that just you or is that the White House? So, we are, as you started out the program, we're in the political world here, and there's going to be all kinds of effort at gotcha. There are going to be all kinds of efforts to rebuff that. And there are plenty of safe harbors, if you will, for Mr. Sessions to go and refuse to answer questions. And, executive privilege is one of those safe harbors that you can pretty easily rely on.
Our guest this hour, if you've just gotten in on this discussion of ethics and the testimony coming today from the Attorney General, Peter Henning is with us. He's a law professor at Wayne State University and with us from Detroit. And Meredith McGeehee is chief of policy programs and strategy at Issue One. And they focus on connecting the dots between money and politics, which is why I'm going to give this next call to you, Meredith. Kathy in Minneapolis. Hi, Kathy. Do you want to talk about? Hi.
Good morning. Great discussion. Thank you. Something may pass the legal test, but it certainly doesn't pass the smell test. And my two favorite things to give examples of is the I applaud the Attorney General's yesterday for the lawsuit on the emoluments clause because I really was wishing that someone would actually dig into the facts and come forth with some chargeable points.
We'll talk
and
about
other,
that in a minute.
And the other
minute.
About
yeah.
The number of lobbyists in relation to the members of Congress so that we have, you know, the influence peddlers and they shut out the voice of the public. So, I think we need some laws to address the ethical issues and put teeth into those laws. So that's my two cents.
Yeah, Kathy, thanks. So, Meredith, is she right about the ratio of lobbyists to members of Congress? And what legally could really be done to address that?
Well, let's start with her first point. Is she right? She's absolutely right. And I did a press call, I think last week, talking to someone who had raised the fact that a trade association, I believe, had gone out and hired, you know, something like 30 or 40 or 50 lobbyists. And they were saying, why would someone hire that many? Don't you just need one or two? And the answer was, you need to come up here and make the members feel like they're surrounded in an echo chamber, that all these different interests, are concerned about this issue. And you can do that by having that many different lobbyists all coming in and you feel like, oh, well, there must be a groundswell of support. And it makes it very hard for the members and particularly the staff, who are generally very young, to kind of get a real clear idea of what the real level of support here is. Now, look, I think lobbying is great. I'm a registered lobbyist. I've been a registered lobbyist since 1987. The combustible cocktail here is when you combine the lobbying activities, obviously, with this huge money pit that has come to dominate Washington. And it's not that money is bad. I don't want to get money out of politics. But when you say, all right, I'm going to go in and lobby and try and convince these members of Congress to take this particular policy action, and that same day and that same night you show up at and you hold a fundraiser for that person, mm-hmm. you bundle money for that person, you make sure that all the folks that are engaged in that give money. You know, this is an advantage that if you are not a moneyed interest, you just can't get in the door. You don't get the access and you don't get the influence. So there's an ethical issue in a lot of ways built into a system that has become out of balance. And I say that not because I alone believe it. I tell you that because this is what I hear every day from members of Congress.
So, Peter, I can't tell you how many politicians I've covered who will say, well, the reason that these lobbyists, you know, give to my campaign or give to me is because we share the same values. I can't be bought off by some contribution of $2,500 during the campaign. What's the answer to that?
Well, certainly they can't be bought for $2,500, but when you see people, members of Congress, joining certain committees because they're a money magnet. So you go on the House Financial Services Committee because you draw the money from Wall Street, or perhaps the mother of all money committees is Ways and Means because of its power over tax. Can they be bought? No, but certainly they can be influenced. And people tend to give money and contributions to people who they support, but you do see a shifting tide. And Meredith is much more familiar with this than I am, but that it's, you know, certain issues draw money with all the talk of tax reform going on. There was a book in the 1980s about the Reagan tax reform where it was Gucci Gulch. And so we're going to see that again. Are the members immune? No, certainly they're not.
Meredith, when I think of an issue like drug price controls on pharmaceuticals, I think, would we, like most other countries in the world, be able to negotiate better prices on drugs if the pharmaceutical company didn't do exactly what you've described about flooding Washington and paying for high price lobbying and influencing members of Congress? Is that an issue that maybe is a good example of this?
It is, though I would caution, because I think a lot of people fall into the trap of this, of saying, you know, things like, you know, either money is bad or get money out of politics. That's just not going to happen. I'm not sure that's what we want to have happen. And I think you have to be careful of saying, oh, if we just, make the system better, we're going to get this particular policy result. I think, I would caution about that. What we do know about the current system is that if you have the resources to go out and buy the high-priced lobbying talent that is on there to create this echo chamber, to, if you will, surround these policymakers in this warm blanket of policy positions that you prefer, mm-hmm. it's going to have effect on them like it would with anyone. They're normal human beings, and when they hear it from a whole bunch of people, there is a realistic assumption made on their part that this must be the popular position. So I think in that sense, if you could begin to, get a little bit more disclosure in the system, you could try and make some changes that get these members out of this world of transactional giving and contributing. I think lobbying is great, as I say. I think it's redressing your grievances is the appropriate and constitutional responsibility of every citizen. The problem here, of course, is that the system has gotten so far out of balance that even the members complain that they can't even figure out where the reality lies.
It's, like, it's so disproportionate, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I want to ask you both about this lawsuit that one of our callers brought up by two attorneys general out of Maryland and Washington, D.C., on how the president is violating the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution by enriching his businesses through some of his policies. And I want you to listen to Washington, D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine on what he says is the reason that the checks and balances have failed here. Here he is.
And every time the president has spoken about drawing a line between his presidency and his businesses, he's walked his promises back. Second, the Republican-controlled Congress has wholly failed to fulfill its responsibility of serving as a check and balance on the president, and has thus far given the president a total pass on his business entanglements.
Peter, maybe first a layman's explanation of what the emoluments clause is, and then to what Carl Racine said there.
Well, I wish I could give a simple explanation. This is one of those little things that's tucked into the Constitution that really has never been dealt with before. There is a prohibition in the Constitution on anyone who is working for the government, so president on down. You can't accept a title of nobility. Well, that was a big deal in the 18th century. It isn't anymore. But you cannot accept any, the line in the Constitution is, any present emolument, office, or title from a foreign state. Well, what this is coming down to is, what is an emolument? It's generally understood to be a benefit, but you know, what is it that you accept? And the Justice Department has argued in their response to another lawsuit raising this very issue is that the president's business is different from the president. Just because he owns a business doesn't mean it's going directly to him. It's only what he receives directly. That's one of their arguments. And so this is going to draw the court into a fight in an area where we just don't really have much guidance.
So, Peter, you're saying that they are in some ways making new claims here in the courts.
Well, new claims, and also it's not clear who can enforce this. The Constitution itself says that you can't accept any of this without the consent of the Congress. And so an argument has been made that this is fine. Maybe the president violated this, but the only place that this can be raised would be in the Congress and not in a lawsuit in front of a federal judge. So you're going to have, this is one of these classic legal requirements, who has standing, who has the right to raise this issue. We'll see whether the attorneys general from Maryland and D.C. have that right. A federal court may well say no. The only people who can deal with this are Congress. And given the current makeup of the Congress with a Republican majority, I doubt it would go anywhere.
Really interesting. Peter, I know you have to run. I really appreciate the time and the insight this hour. Thank you much.
Well, thank you so much. I'm actually coming to Minneapolis. So
today?
Yes.
Ah, well, we've got some hot and steamy weather waiting for you. So
can't wait. Thank you so much.
Peter Henning is a law professor at Wayne State University, joining us from Detroit. Meredith, I wanted to ask you about something that Time Magazine's writing about this week. Their cover article is on the ethics and the businesses that the president owns and promotes. And the first paragraph of the article says, a president who once promised to drain the swamp of influence peddling now owns the city's newest bog. And one of the examples that the article is citing is that countries like Bahrain and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia are sending millions of dollars of business to Trump's hotel chain because they think that's going to be advantageous potentially for policy that will affect the countries. How difficult is it to really tease out decisions like that?
Well, it's incredibly difficult. And, this is in unprecedented territory. And I want to kind of, if you will, do a little bit of a balanced thought here, because I think
Sure.
what you're seeing politically, and one of the reasons that the Republicans especially are defending the president, is that you have a president that came in and said, I want to disrupt the status quo. And Lord knows that's what he's doing.
Right.
He's doing it on a personal level. He's doing it on a political level. He's doing it on an international level. And that appeals to some part of the base that supports both the president and the Republican Congress, who looks at him and says, here's a guy who is at the top of the ticket who delivered us the Congress, control of the Congress. So there is great reluctance to abandon him. At the same time, when you say, I want to, kind of turn everything topsy-turvy, there are many traditions that were important to making a democracy function that United States has had for years, this notion that the president cannot have a conflict of interest. That's never been in the tradition here. Yes, as Peter said, the president is not covered by the Ethics in Government Act, but there have been traditions that presidents have followed to try and, if you will, make the lubrication of democracy work. So we're getting a double-edged sword here. A president's coming in and saying, I was elected to turn everything upside down. That's what I'm doing. And then the other side of that is a president who has unprecedented personal conflicts of interest with his business, a president who is treating our allies in ways that are, kind of unprecedented. And this is the world that we are living in right now. And the question is, where are those ethical standards that the American people, or at least the majority of American people, can agree on? And obviously, that agreement is hard to come by.
A call here, I think, that goes to that from Kathy in Minneapolis. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a question. I think there's something in the Constitution that says that voters are not supposed to be taxed without representation. And I kind of feel like right now the people in Congress and the government are representing the lobbyists and the big businesses that make contributions to the political campaign. So I really feel like we the people and the voters are not being represented by our elected officials. They're really representing the people that enable them to get elected and give them campaign donations.
Meredith, you've probably heard that before, too.
And I would say, I can say without hesitation, she's absolutely correct. And that's not, and there's a reason for it. And the reason is, right now, only 0.5% of all Americans, so think about that statistic, 0.5% of all Americans give a federal candidate $200 or more.
Wow.
So,
yeah, that's lower than I thought it was.
I mean, it's a shockingly low number. And so who are the members going to, when they get elected, who do they feel like they represent? The people that got them there. It's a pretty natural reaction.
Although we should say that in states like Minnesota, there is money that then once a candidate reaches a certain level and passes a primary, and then if they choose to abide by the rules, then they get what ends up being taxpayer money, I believe, for the campaign.
At the state level, but not for the federal level. That's a state-level system, and it does not apply in the federal races. They are dancing. You can think of it two ways. They're dancing with the ones that brung them, or, he who pays the piper calls the tune. Pick your metaphor here. That's where we are. So do you feel unrepresented? Well, of course you're unrepresented. You go to the poll, all you have is a vote. But in the end, they are looking to the people that they feel helped get them reelected. And that's that 0.5% of all Americans who even gave $200, much less any of the other big donors, of course, that are playing in the system. So, this is not something where it means that a politician, if they're smart, ignores their constituency. Lord knows if you come to Washington, you would think that you can get a meeting with your member of Congress. But in the policymaking process, much of which now is increasingly done behind closed doors, that ability to get access turns into influence. And if you don't pony up a fair amount of chunk of change, that access is very difficult to get. Or all you get is the photo shoot, that photo opportunity while the real decisions are being made in different rooms. So I think your caller is absolutely right. There are solutions. I want to make very clear, it doesn't have to be this way. There are solutions to begin to change the system. I think what Minnesota does, particularly with the tax rebate that Minnesota has had off and on in the past, has been a really good model that we're looking at a national level and talking to members of Congress about. If anything, I want to leave your listeners with is, it doesn't have to be this way. This is not a hopeless situation. There are solutions. But it's very difficult, obviously, unless you really get an opportunity to start holding your members accountable and feeling like they'll listen to you.
So, Meredith, every now and then we talk about money in politics. And why don't you come back sometime soon and we'll talk about some of these solutions, right? Because I think we have an audience very interested in that. So is that good?
Yep. That'd be great.
All right, good. Thank you. Thanks very much for today.
Thank you for having me.
Meredith McGee is Chief of Policy Programs and Strategy at Issue One, and they connect between money and politics. So more conversations about this to come.
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.